morning, Mr. Malunga. I am Jojo James. I'm chairing this interview panel. I want to put you at ease, to relax. We are not here to pester you, but we are here to ask questions. At any given point in time during this interview, you are welcome to drink water if you feel like drinking water. The questions will be more practical than theoretical, but we will appreciate if you can balance the theory with practice as you answer the questions. Having said that, though, let me start with my question. Please introduce yourself, Mr. By telling us about your background and experience and why do you want to be a commissioner in the Public Service Commission.
Should I proceed, Chair? Thank you. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, honorable members. My name is Kevin Sviso Malunga. I am currently Deputy Public Protector of South Africa. My term ends in December 9, 2019. So it's been quite a very interesting 7 years of holding the state to account. In light of this, this is linked to my work, my current work in terms of holding the public administration accountable. That's one of the passions that I've had over the years. I worked for government, for the Department of Justice as a state law advisor before that, assisted in the setting up of the Marikana Commission, and of course the setting up of the Office of the Chief Justice. I would declare that is where our paths crossed with the current chair of the Public Service Commission, who was my boss at the time. And of course, I have worked in academia I've lectured at this University of Natal. I'm a naturalized South African citizen. I was born in Wabulawayo, the land of Mzilikazi. I nationalized as a South African citizen in 2010. So, and of course, I studied at the University of Swaziland. I did a BA law, and I did an LLB at the University of Natal, Pietermaritzburg. And I taught at the University of Natal, Pietermaritzburg thereafter. I then went to do a master's in law at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And I am a doctoral candidate at the University of Wisconsin in the United States, part-time, of course, or writing about economic justice and housing rights in South Africa. So my journey has been to promote what I can say is administrative justice, social justice. I feel like I'm very passionate about that and giving dignity to people. And of course, the public administration or government or the state is the one primary example where people face the reality of delivery of services. Their quality of life is determined largely by what the state does for them. And in my current role in the past 7 years, I've experienced a lot of what is the power of an efficient public official or an inefficient one. What is the power of an honest or a dishonest one? And I feel that my contribution is not complete. I feel that the Public Service Commission has a very big role to play, especially in terms of the role of investigation, monitoring of the state and how it does business in terms of how how it takes care of its people and so forth. I feel very strongly that public officials need to understand their power to change this country. And I feel very strongly that the Public Service Commission is one way in which I can do that. I have found that there are so many things that are happening in the state that have compromised service delivery. So when the Constitution talks about an ethical and transparent and efficient public service, they are talking about an ethical and efficient South Africa, because that comes from what the public officials. So I think it's really a question of continuation of the work that I have been doing as Deputy Public Protector over the past 7 years, holding the state to account, and in fact not just holding the state to account, but assisting the state to perform better. Thank you, Chair.
The Public Service Commission has a constitutional mandate to promote the values and principles of Section 195. Then the question is, what is your understanding of the values and principles enshrined in Section 195 of the Constitution? Please mention a few and elaborate where you feel like elaboration. And then the second question from my, can you briefly, what is your understanding of the functions of the Public Service Commission?
Values and principles that are in Section 195 of the Constitution. I think it's about 6-7 of them. There's quite a list of them. They talk about the development-oriented public service. They talk about transparency. They talk about, efficiency and integrity. But my understanding is these are the values that have been prescribed by the Constitution in Section 195. As to how the public service must conduct itself, at the bottom there they are talking about the fact that these values apply to all organs of state at all levels, at provincial, at national, and local. But in other words, I would say, you know, to use a religious example, they are the Quran or the Bible or whatever you want to call of the public service that they must comply with. As I indicated, there are about 6 or 7 of them. I'm not a crammer, but I remember integrity, I remember the development-oriented state, I remember ethics, and so forth. But and then, of course, the functions of the Public Service Commission, we are talking about a Section 10, Chapter 10, constitutional institution that is an independent institution that has the duty to investigate, evaluate, and monitor the conduct of the public administration. And also there are a number of duties there, such as advisory duties, investigative, monitoring things such as the financial conduct and interests of public officials. At the provincial level, there is an obligation to report to the provincial legislature in question. Hence, you have the provincial public service commissioner, and of course, nationally, the public service commission will report to you once a year. But my understanding of the public service commission is that it is there to ensure that South Africa has a public service or a public administration that is steeped in those same constitutional values and principles and is efficient, is not wasteful. There's also talk there back to the principles that, you know, efficient use of resources and so forth. So my understanding is that this is a Chapter 10 institution. In other words, it is also an institution supporting constitutional democracy.
Thank you, Honorable Song. The members of the interview panel are going to introduce themselves before they ask questions. I'm now calling on Honorable Nesong.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning, colleagues, and good morning, Mr. Malonga. And thanks so much for availing yourself to allow us to know you better than we knew only a few days. My question on through Honorable Chair is around the legislative mandate, which you might have or you may not have responded already, but I just want to be more focused and hear better on that space. I'll make a statement that I'll follow with the question. The Constitution provides for much stronger role of Public Service Commission in upholding the principles of public administration. One of its functions is to give direction, aid and ensuring that personal procedures relating to recruitment, transfer, promotion and dismissal comply with the values and principles of the public administration as well. Mr. Malunga, what can be the best strategy in assisting the Public Service Commission to ensure that government departments appoint competent and dedicated public servants, particularly at the senior management level?
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Nesong. Actually, that is one of my passions in my current role, the issue of the level of dedication and competence. That particular statement, which comes from the Constitution, giving directives on recruitment, transfers, and dismissals, and so forth, is one that is often at the heart of disputes that come through. And I certainly feel that the best way of doing this to address some of the challenges that you raise is that people understand their duties, that is very clear before they are appointed, first and foremost. Secondly, the issue of conflict of interest, management of conflict of interest, so that is one of the passions that I found to be a very sorely lacking, that there is a failure to understand conflict of interest by public officials, and therefore they are not able to understand that something is not something that they're supposed to be doing or not. And of course, very often, they must also be trained, and this is something that I have been doing with the National School of Government, that they must, your other entity, which I think accounts to you, the National School of Government, must come and train public officials. There are already compulsory courses that they are giving across the country, but they must go out there and tell people what is right and wrong. I feel that is not being done enough, ma'am. And we feel it's a passion that I have, been working on with the current Public Service Commission in terms of our memorandum of understanding. You will see that in the annual report they've alluded to that. But I feel that people sometimes say we didn't know what we were supposed to do. Sometimes they know what they were supposed to do, but there are inadequate consequences for that behavior, for the wrong behavior. So I think that's a mouthful, but I feel very strongly that there should be synergy as well between these institutions supporting democracy, between your Public Service Commission, your provincial legislatures, and other institutions supporting democracy. Because I think there is a lack of acceptance of what is the right public official, what should they be doing? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Maluma, through your chair. Hopefully it's the last question from my side. It's what you alluded to earlier on of a developmental state. National Development Plan made an emphasis that South Africa needs to build a state that is capable of playing a developmental and transformative role. My question is in two forms. There are two questions almost in one. The first sub of the question, Mr. Malunga, what are the challenges that hinder public administration in potentially realizing a developmental state? Secondly, what sort of public service is required by South Africa to achieve its developmental objectives? Mind you, I did say earlier on that you might have responded to this question, but do you love also to elaborate or amplify in some of the questions? Thank you so much.
Repeat the second question. I got the first one.
You put request through me, but
I'm sorry.
The Honorable Lesoma has had you. You can
answer
that?
Through you, Chair. Through you, Chair.
Can you repeat that?
Thank you, Chair, through yourself as well from my side. What sort of public service is required by South Africa to achieve a developmental objective? Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Through you, Chair, the challenges, what are the challenges that hinder a developmental state? Chair, I don't want to go in a round-minded fashion, but I have had opportunity to do some anti-corruption training in some countries which are very much like us. Singapore, you know, they were like us at some point, with the UAE and so forth, the countries which are once so-called poor, developmental, with many developmental challenges that that we endure. We look at Mr. Paul Kagame in Rwanda, how he has transformed. You know, a country that was in chaos. I'm using those analogies to show that the challenges with us are largely governance-related issues. I'll use another example of where I was born. I know the honorable member from BFF might have a different view from Zimbabwe and how that economy fell apart. It was a lot about behavior of governments. In other words, the challenges that we face, mostly corruption, and a lot of it has to do with not taking, you know, we bring a lot of these nice policies every year, year in, year out. The chair, you are given annual reports, nice annual reports. You are given all these lovely documents. But implementation, as they say in slang, dololo, you know, there's no implementation. So that's one of the biggest ones, corruption and, of course, lack of implementation. And what sort of public service is required to achieve this? I think mostly selfless, dedicated. That is not about money. Of course, I feel that I agree with the Singapore model where you pay the public servants well so that they do not become corrupt. I don't think it should be a hardship to be in the public service that you pay them peanuts. But I feel very strongly that we need a public service that understands the developmental outcomes of their behavior or misbehavior. When they misbehave, they destroy the country. Very often, in my current role, when we go to municipalities, for example, where there are service delivery protests, or even national departments under whose purview you have, you find that there is a lack of consideration by the public service officials. In other words, they don't care. They just earn their salary. When people are complaining about things, they don't care about what is happening. And so, and as a result, development and service delivery suffers. So I think if people get that message, we will have that kind of developmental state that is not just a lip service or does not belong to documents and so forth. And of course, I think Pan-Africanism as well, across the continent, people understanding that as Africans, we are one people. And the more we rise together, the more we rise, and the more we divide, we fall together. Thank you very much.
Another one, please.
Morning, Ms. Malonga. I am Honorable Citizen Member of the Committee. I'm going to ask you about a good governance. Effective governance in the public sector encourages better decision making and efficient use of resources. So how would you define good governance? That was question one. And question two would be, what are the five main principles of good governance within the context of a democratic government and efficient public services? Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, through you, Chair. And thank you, Honorable Swissi. How would I define good governance? My understanding of good governance, of course, there's so many documents that talk about this. You've got National Development Plan, you've got reports coming from Public Service Commission and Public Protector and so forth. Is that at the very apex of this is efficiency. A good government is a government that is efficient, that performs the role that it has set out, for whatever department or municipality or role it has to play. And some of the elements that I can come up with are things such as for me, one of the big one is accountability. Efficiency being one of them. So the third then be a thriftiness, if I can call it that, with resources. In other words, optimal use of resources. Fourthly, you have a culture of people-centeredness. And I would say also a participatory, in other words, people first, in light of section 195, what they call Batupele. And there are many. For me, dignity comes as one. In other words, some of the rights enshrined in the Bill of Rights are not inseparable from good governance. You've got to have a situation where you respect people. But as I say, Honorable Speaker, there are a number of documents that come through that talk about things such as the rule of law. That without the rule of law, you cannot have good governance. It's a potentially very interesting sort of maybe academic debate. But those are some of the elements that I feel come strongly. But one of my passions in this regard is accountability. That you need to have an accountable state. You need to have an accountable public administration. Thank you.
Honorable Speaker.
Thank you, Chairperson. And first of all, allow me to apologize to you, Chair, to the members, and also to Mr. Malunga for running late. I thought that I'd figured out Cape Town traffic, but apparently not quite yet. So anyway, thank you very much, Mr. Malunga, for availing yourself. My name is Leon Schreiber. I am a member of this subcommittee and also of the Portfolio Committee on Public Service and Administration. My question relates to the perennial issue of corruption, but I'd like you to zoom in specifically on the issue of public service doing business with the state. As you know, this is an issue that has already been addressed in legislation, so I think it goes back to your point about things that exist on paper, but in practice we still have, and we recently in fact had new information from the department that this is in fact continuing. So what would be your suggestion to practically eliminate this specific form of unethical behavior, public servants doing business with the state? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Shaiba. This is something that I currently enjoy doing, as I said. Not corruption, but... the fight, as I indicated, against corruption. As you have alluded, the PAM Act, they call it the PAM Act, Public Administration Management, came with a lot of excitement, and people were looking forward to this. But I've seen from the recent Public Service Commission, for example, annual report and so forth, that the level of compliance of people declaring and so forth is not enough. I think in the bigger picture, the fight against corruption in South Africa has not been won adequately because of insufficient consequences for behavior that is corrupt. Lifestyle audits have been promised for years. People are living above their means. There is not insufficient ways of dealing with that. For me, the one or two issues that really would address this are firstly where the criminal justice system acts more, even against public administration and officials, but also as a forfeiture. In other words, because people generally tend to keep the proceeds of ill-gotten wealth. So I see the NPA and so forth are doing their work very hard. But back to why I am here today to say, being part of the Public Service Commission, I would then assist them to bring out their anti-corruption capacity. And something that I've had lots of experience in this particular role as Deputy Public Protector over the past 7 years, to assist them with international best practice, to say, look, that hotline that they have, which has over the years done some good work, how can it be improved, and how can there be greater synergy between that particular initiative of the Public Service Commission and the other, because certainly corruption, you can't fight it on your own. Even Parliament is too big an elephant even for Parliament itself. It has to be fought. You know that African saying that you want to eat an elephant, you have to eat it together. So I think it's one of those where it would need a multi-sector sort of... And lifestyle audits, there's been talk about this for years. SARS, synergy with SARS, certainly the Public Service Commission, is in a space to get involved there, where people, it's not an invasion of privacy to fail to understand why does someone who earns $1 million a year have $10 million in their bank account. It's not an unreasonable question to ask that kind of question. Why are you living above your means? We have been frustrated in my role, working both under Advocate Madonsela and under Advocate Mkwebane,
there are things where you can see that something is happening here. But it just has a dead end because the follow-through is insufficient. And that's where I think we need to tighten our screws. Thank you.
For the sake of consistency, Mr. Maluka, because I've been asking this question since the previous candidate last week as well, so I think I must raise this question. Well, to get your view on vetting, what is your view on vetting in dealing with the subject matter that has been asked by Dr. Strang? Thank you.
Through you, Chair. Vetting of public officials, or vetting of ourselves, or candidates, which one in particular?
I think, through you, Chair, I didn't want to confine you, but I'm saying that we're dealing with the public level. So there's this perception, I'm using that word very carefully, without making allegations, perception that public servants, in particular senior management, they don't feel comfortable to be vetted. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Very much. Thank you, Chair. Through you, Chair. That's a very hot potato in the past few years because I will give you an example of the fact that ESCOM officials in the past few weeks refused to be vetted, about 100 something of them. A lot of this has to do, Chair, with the challenges that have faced the state security agencies over the past maybe, I don't know how many years. Where we ourselves, for example, would receive complaints against the agency that is doing the vetting about abuse of funds, abuse of this, or politicization of certain procedures. So, in principle, I don't have a problem with people being vetted. Actually, it's important that this panel knows that people don't have a criminal record, that people don't have they don't have domestic violence, they're not unsuitable people prone to domestic violence and all sorts of things like that. So that is fine. Of course, I think the issue then that would have to be decided is who does the vetting. And those people doing the monitoring and the vetting must themselves have clean hands. Because that has been a challenge over the past few years. We have been caught in that space where people allege politicization of such entities. And it becomes very problematic. And I think, just to belabor the point, one day you find that, ma'am, you are nominated to serve as an ambassador of South Africa, maybe to China. And someone doesn't want you to be ambassador. And they'll say, let's vet her properly, you know? And you find that vetting is actually used as a tool against you. So it has to be very, I just want to belabor the point that I'm not opposed to background checks. They're very important. But I feel very strongly that this particular area has been, in the past few years, been a hot potato. I don't want to raise too much of the work that I'm currently doing, where you have a complaint on your desk about theft of billions of money by the same people who are supposed to be in the vetting agencies or integrity people. It creates that challenge that then you... Thank you very much.
Honorable Kibi.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. Mr. Malunga, welcome and good morning. Thank you for being with us here today on this rainy day. My question will be on strengthening oversight. PSC is doing oversight as well as Parliament. Now my question to you would be, how do you think PSC can strengthen its oversight and oversight also by Parliament?
Thank you, Larry. Thanks. I've seen in the legislation and the constitutional provisions that in Section 195 and 196 and the Public Service Commission Act of 1997, there's talk about advice and directives and so forth that's what the Public Service Commission does. And I think that's what pretty much the Auditor General had a problem with a while ago, before the mandate and the teeth were made bigger. So I think the Public Service Commission right now exposes the problem. In other words, they're able to tell you what the problem is. But I don't think they have enough teeth to bite and say, now that you have misbehaved in a particular way, what happens to you? And that Parliament rectified that same challenge with the Auditor General. And I think we might have to consider that with the Public Service Commission. I mean, currently we have a memorandum of understanding between Public Protector and Public Service Commission and other entities to ensure that this actually happens, so that we work together. I've managed referrals over the years to ensure that some of the things that the Public Service Commission wants done are actually done. But in terms of Parliament's oversight, I think it's something that obviously needs to be a multi-committee project, because the officials that are being complained about come from different departments. You'll find that someone is complaining about the DG of Human Settlements to you here, or to the Public Service Commission. But the Portfolio Committee on Human Settlements may not have full information on that. So I think it's very important that there's that synergy, even amongst yourselves as portfolio committees, probably maybe using the ISD office, in the Speaker's office, or some other tool to ensure that you have sufficient oversight. I had led, for example, the investigation into the Cleveland Hostel in Devon, where people had been killed, and it deals with a lot of departments, safety and security, it has human settlements issues, it has water issues, it has cocktail issues. So, but when those departments are not performing, we then struggle to say which one do we take it to, and who is the one ultimately who can, how do we chase those officials in those particular departments? We can bring it to you, but I think there's a need to have. So I think it's actually a question of synergy and knowing what the right hand is doing when the left hand is doing this. That is what is missing right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Malunga. I'm sorry, I forgot to introduce myself. I'm Miriam Kiyu, a member of this panel and also of the committee. My second question is, if you still remember, during the State of Nation Address, President outlined 7 priorities for the 6th administration. Among it is to build capable, ethical and developmental state, which is what Chapter 10 of the Constitution envisages. Now my question is, what role should the PSC play in ensuring realization of building capable, ethical, and developmental states?
Thank you. Through you, Chair. Thanks, ma'am. I just want to give some background, because I'm already involved in this space that you have alluded to through my partnerships and works with the National School of Government, which reports to you, if I'm not mistaken, as a And earlier on, just after the president issued the statement, they set up compulsory courses for public officials across the country. And they invited us to that launch and have therefore then invited me, for example, to give presentations on things like, something which I'm passionate about, whistleblowers, corruption, and so forth. So the role of the PSC, in my view, would be then to partner with those sister agencies under its purview, which are your National School of Government, Parliament, and of course others, to ensure that people know what is an ethical state, what is a capable, and what is a developmental state. Because right now, sometimes people receive these slogans at the State of the Nation, and then they wait for the next State of the Nation. So I'm happy that there is something that is being done. So the role of the PSC would be to have a certainly, if it needs to be, even if it's a roadshow nationally, to go out and let people know what does the Public Service Commission do. What is the impact of things like conflict of interest? What is unethical behavior? And so forth and so on. Because currently you find that someone will say, I didn't know, you know, I did this because I didn't know it was wrong. You know, you speak to, sometimes we do unannounced visits to testing stations. You find that the person who owns the driving school that is doing the testing is the same person that is doing the testing. And you ask them, but do you know that this is unethical? They say, no, I didn't know that was unethical. So those are the challenges that I have seen practically. And I hope to bring that experience that I will just hit the ground running, because I have been working with the commissioners and people like the School of Government in some of these issues that you have alluded to.
Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. My committee here, Honorable, and the Office of the Committee, and Mr. Malunga. I'm Honorable Mutsepe, and I'm the member of this committee and also the member of the portfolio. So I've got a question for you. The financial disclosure framework is aimed at preventing conflicts of interest by requiring members of the senior management service to disclose their financial interest. So the question is, provide an explanation on how the financial disclosure works. Thank you.
Thank you, through you, Chair. My understanding is that the Public Service Commission is a repository of this information. They know this, especially at SMS level, people are supposed to declare, and this is something that is managed largely by the accounting officer to say, declare your interests. Do you have a business? Are you doing business with the state? Are you what properties do you own? Etc. And this is something that I have seen in the annual reports of the Public Service Commission and their documents as something that they manage in terms of the senior members' SMS. Of course, feel that it could be put out quite widely, because there are people who don't want to be in the SMS because of the fact of these disclosure requirements. In fact, I jump back to my driving school example. An official at the Department of Transport or some other department will refuse a promotion
get bribes in a lower position. That's a fact. We've seen that happening. So my answer back to the core of your question is that this is a system where people disclose what they own, whether there's no conflict of interest and so forth. The verdict generally is that it is not enough.
Ministers or MECs can delegate the power to officials within the department. Then the question, my question will be in twofold. The first question will be in twofold. The first part of the question is, what are the major obstacles in the recruitment system in the public sector? That is the first part. The second part is the public sector recruitment system effective in order to ensure professional and capable state? That was the first question. The second one is, what can be the role of the PSC in eliminating unethical practices in the recruitment system in order to ensure public servants are appointed based on merit?
Thank you, Chair. My understanding in terms of the current obstacles that face recruitment is first and foremost the perceptions that's around the public service, the image of the public service as an employer of choice. First and foremost, I think, which is sometimes very unfair to the public service because there are a lot of hardworking and efficient people who are working in the public service. So that is the first obstacle. The second is financial. Even though I personally don't feel that public servants, especially senior ones in South Africa, I think they're actually paid quite well. Remuneration, you know, when they compare with what they are going to earn at Microsoft or South African breweries and so forth, there's likely that that may be an obstacle. And of course, the other one is corruption and recruitment, nepotism, which is something that comes up very often as complaints to Public Service Commission, to Public Protector, and so forth. In fact, a lot of the reports that we have been involved in recently within the context of the Public Protector have dealt with appointments. And it's across the political spectrum, you know. ANC-led municipalities, DA-led municipalities, have found themselves wanting in this area of
appointments of officials. It's on record. We had Marietje Okamp in Pretoria. We have had some in the other places in Northwest and so forth. So it's failure to follow policies sometimes. Recruitment policies. In other words, what must be done. Sometimes it's not really corruption in the well-known sense. Just a failure to follow proper policies. That before you appoint someone, do X, Y, and Z. That was not done. Does the person have proper qualifications? You find that someone really wants a particular person. They are told you must appoint so and so. And they say, but sir, ma'am, appoint so and so. And those are the challenges that we see very often. So how a public service commission would get into that space is to make it clear through training people all over the country, through nice, simple-to-read material that is available on every public official's coffee table as to what are the requirements to train someone properly. Unfortunately, one thing that I like to humbly claim is that I'm a reader and I'm a researcher. So those are some of the things that I would maybe assist them to come up with, especially in the Pretoria office. And it's something that I actually have already been doing with some of the commissioners already. But that's what I think the Public Service Commission would do, ma'am. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Again, this is a question that I've asked every candidate in the same way that my colleague has. But you raised this issue very pertinently here, and let's call it by its name. It doesn't matter who it's practiced by, it's known as cadre deployment. My question to you then is a very straightforward one, and I would appreciate, Chair, if the candidate can give a solid answer here. Do you think that the practice of cadre deployment, of political bosses being able to influence appointments, is something that is ethical and appropriate? Or should it be done away with, perhaps through strengthening the role of the PSC when it comes to appointments? I'd appreciate your input on that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's one of the most difficult questions today. Partly because my understanding is, of course, that political principles all over the world, right, usually bring, they ask elected, and then they bring in people. They usually want people who they feel they can trust, if I can put it that way. So you see it with Barack Obama, Macron, wherever you go. But I think the issue is the quality of the people who are then brought in to serve those people. Because, and I think that's for me the challenge. I don't think we can completely eradicate the desire that political office bearers have to work with people they trust. I think that's a global phenomenon. But I think where it goes wrong, especially in South Africa, is where you then put incompetent people or unethical people to assist you. So that's where there must be the PSC could assist with some sort of vetting or guideline system to say, if at least you're going to be the chief of staff of a premier somewhere, you must have X or Y qualification or this kind of experience. He, you know, even though he's a person that he likes or whatever, it's not enough that being liked should not be a qualification. I think that's the part where I would say is unethical, where you say, you know what, we're bringing in people no matter what. And that has gone very wrong. So I think you can bring in your people, but they must be qualified and capable to do the job.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Just for clarity, question is not in relation to advisors or even a chief of staff. We all recognize that there will always be a certain group of people, but if you define who they are, those who are political appointees, then that is something that is indeed up to the political principle. My question relates to the professional public service. So we're starting from the DGs, the chief directors, etc., the people in the public service who are not political appointees, even in other countries. So my question, just to follow up then, is specifically in the case of those, if we leave aside advisors and we all recognize that there will always be a chief of staff or an advisor to some extent, who will be closer to the politician, on the side of those professional officials, what is your view on getting employment?
Thank you, Chair. On that part, I feel very strongly that we must get. In fact, the Constitution is very clear. It says an efficient, ethical public service. That's what Section 195 and 196 are saying. So, regardless of who is in power, because power is a very fluid thing. You know, today is this party, tomorrow is the other one. Those principles are fixed constitutional principles. That will change, that will remain static regardless of who is in power. So I certainly feel that indeed you must appoint people who are qualified or capable. It shouldn't be politicized at all. So it's that other part that I was referring to where it's almost impossible to because of the trust nature of the political space, that obviously someone will want the chief of staff that they believe in. But otherwise, chief directors, because the chief directors stay on, my understanding, after a minister comes and goes. So the thinking would then be to say those people must be people of high capability. They carry a lot of institutional memory and so forth. And there I think I would be firm to say it must be a professional person.
Is there any question you would like to put to the committee or a comment you would like to make?
Now, Chair, I just want to thank the committee for indulging me in my request to have a postponement because of my travel commitment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Malonga. You will be informed in writing of the outcomes of this interview. Thank you very much. You are released, brother. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee Members.
Thank you, Mr. Malonga.